Ransom and his men were airborne by mid-morning, with Santiago acting as gunner co-pilot and Ransom sitting in the back just behind the pilot. In the loading area behind him, 10 of the men Santiago had recruited for the job were strapped into the crew seats on either side of the hull, ready to be deployed at a moment's notice once they hit the ground. Ransom's feelings positively soared when they discovered the remainder of Davenport's convoy parked just outside the forest that covered the approach to the slopes of Burkhan Khaldun. The pilot landed nearby, and Santiago got out with several of his men to search the vehicles. They returned to the helicopter 15 minutes later, and as the pilot took them back up, Santiago reported what they had found.
Engines are cold, which means they've probably been here overnight. Looks like they took their gear and headed off into the woods over there.
He pointed down to a narrow path just beyond the parked vehicles that could easily be seen from the air.
There was some blood on one of the seats, so at least one of them has been injured recently. That's about it.
Ransom nodded and sat back to think, watching the scenery pass by beneath the aircraft without actually seeing it. The bloodstains gave a possible explanation for why the team had separated. It was likely that one of them had needed serious medical attention, and Mason Jones had been stupid enough to split his forces in two while his enemy was nipping at his heels. It also meant that there would be fewer of Davenport's team to contend with when Ransom and his men caught up, giving them the numerical advantage, which was just fine with him. It took them another 15 minutes to cover the ground that Davenport and his team had taken hours to climb the day before. Still, when the pilot put the helicopter down in a small clearing, Ransom was happy enough to get out and stretch his legs. Santiago had the men fan out, sending them up the mountain. It didn't take them much longer to locate the trail Davenport and his team had used. The trail wasn't all that old, and Ransom felt the thrill of the hunt course through his system. He knew his prey was close, and if he played his cards right, he might even catch up to them before nightfall. Ransom ordered the ground team to start following Davenport's team on foot, while he and Santiago returned to the air to provide aerial recon and additional firepower, if it came to that. As he took to the sky once more, Ransom stared down at his men as they disappeared into the forest ahead of them.
Time's almost up, Davenport. Time's almost up.
1 minute, Davenport's party was deep in the forest. And then next, the trees suddenly fell back on all sides as the trail led them right into the midst of a sunlit clearing. Three other trails could be seen emerging from the forest and ending at other locations around the clearing, but the group paid the trails little mind at this point, for the small hill that rose before them, carpeted with a thick sheen of green grass, had them all entranced. Atop the hill stood 12 spirit banners, the horsehair attached to their shafts, stirring in the slight breeze. Nambai pointed up over the hill, through the break in the trees caused by the clearing, to where the cliff face of the rising mountain behind it could be seen. A cave entrance was visible a few hundred feet up the sheer cliff, and what looked like two solda stood guard on either side of the entrance. Anya felt her heart go into overdrive.
The tomb of Genghis Khan.
The horse tracks in the dirt were forgotten. They skirted the ceremonial hill, only to find the entrance of a fourth and fifth trail very close to each other, directly on the other side. Mason sent Vale and Williams along the right-hand path, telling them to go down a short way and then report back, while he and Nambai did the same on the left. When everyone returned, Vale described a canyon spanned by a rope bridge that appeared to be in disuse. Many of the wooden slats were missing from the flooring, and the ropes themselves seemed brittle and worn. On the other hand, the trail Mason and Nambai had followed led to the base of the cliff they had seen from the clearing. The decision was an easy one. A few minutes later, they all stood staring up at the cave mouth, roughly 100 feet above them. The cliff face leading up to it was almost vertical, with no obvious means of ascent short of climbing like a spider on a wall.
This is going to be fun.
Come on now. Don't tell me you're afraid of heights.
Mason did his best to ignore her, which Anya found even funnier. Williams, the most experienced climber in the group, was pulling wrapped coils of rope out of his pack when Anya moved to join him and offer assistance. They discussed the route they intended to take and the gear they were going to use to protect the route on the way up. Once they were both satisfied, they got underway, with Anya leading and setting the protection, and Williams belaying her. The climb itself went very quickly. There was no ledge to speak of in front of the cave entrance, so Anya was forced to enter the cave mouth in order to find a place to set the anchors for the rope. The sunlight coming in from outside illuminated the first 10 or so feet of the tunnel, allowing her to see what she was doing and secure the rope properly, so that the others could make the climb up to the cavern. She could also see that the tunnel continued deep into the mountainside. As she turned back toward the entrance, she discovered a pile of torches on the floor to the left side of the entrance. Anya leaned out of the cave mouth and waved to the others below, indicating it was okay for them to use the rope to climb up. While she waited for them, she lit one of the torches and moved a short distance down the tunnel, her excitement almost palpable in the narrow confines of the passage. As it turned out, there was only so far she could go. About 40 feet in, she discovered two massive wooden doors blocking the passage, each one reinforced with several bands of iron that ran horizontally across them. Anya guessed that they probably weighed several hundred pounds each. By the light of her torch, she could see that the stone on either side of the doors had been carved with excruciating detail, reminding Anya of any number of the Buddhist temples they had passed during their trip across the country, especially the one at Shank. The carvings were obviously old, but protected from the harsh Mongolian winds in the depths of the tunnel, they stood out in stark relief. The doors looked as if they had stood undisturbed for centuries, provided you ignored the footprints that led up to the doors. When the rest of the group caught up with Anya, there was more than one gasp of surprise at the sight of the doors ahead of her. Mason eyed the closed doors as if all the demons from hell lurked behind them.
What now?
Maybe he dislikes being underground as much as he dislikes heights.
Anya decided that making fun of his fear of heights was enough for one day.
I say we go in and have a look around.
How do you expect to do that? Last time I looked, our gear list didn't include any C4.
Anya just reached out with one hand and gave a gentle push. The door on the right swung open without a sound.
How the hell?
Mason shook his head at his own lack of insight. One set of footsteps led up to the doors. One set of footsteps led away. Obviously, it hadn't taken more than a single individual to open the doors previously, so it stood to reason that they could do it too. Torch in hand, Anya stepped inside. The tunnel continued on the other side for a short distance and then opened up into a wide chamber hewn from living rock. Stunned at what she was seeing, Anya slowly moved into the space. Every square inch of the walls had been covered with painted images of Mongol life in bright, vibrant colors. Most, if not all of them, focused on a dark-haired boy and showed him in various scenes of everyday life. He could be seen milking goats in the early morning sunlight. He was helping herd the flocks on the wide steppes. He was fishing in the dark waters of a broad lake, and he was learning to ride one of the short, stout horses the Mongols used for warfare. She moved around the room, taking it all in as the others followed behind her. From the similarities in the paintings, it seemed that they had all been done by the same hand. She didn't want to think of the time and energy involved in creating such a huge and moving masterpiece.
The figure in these paintings, is it who I think it is?
Yeah, if I had to guess, I'd say yes. We're most likely looking at scenes from the early life of Temujin, the child who would grow up to become Genghis Khan.
The paintings alone were an incredible find. There were no written records of the Khan's life contemporaneous to his lifetime. The only surviving account in existence, a text known as The Secret History of the Mongols, was written by an anonymous author on behalf of the royal family sometime after his death. It was likely full of as much myth as it was fact. But these, if they proved to be authentic, would be of incalculable value in understanding the early life of one of history's most enigmatic figures. Anya was nearly breathless with discovery.
Hey, there's a door here!
Suddenly, everyone was rushing to Jeffrey's side, including Anya. He was right. A particularly bright painting of the young Mongol warrior learning to fire his bow concealed a door set into the rear of the chamber. It was much smaller and far less grandiose than the doors they'd just passed through, but it appeared to be the only way out of the chamber. It opened easily at their touch, revealing another passageway like the one through which they had first entered. Leaving the painted chamber behind, they headed off down the tunnel. The tunnel was wide enough to allow them to walk two abreast, and Anya had Mason join her up front, he on the right and she on the left. She was surprised by the quality of the air as they moved deeper into the tunnel. She'd been expecting it to be dusty and stagnant, and yet it was almost the exact opposite, crisp and cool. There must be another opening at the other end, she thought, allowing the air to move about. She was about to mention her thought to Mason when the floor gave way under her feet. Anya dropped her torch and lunged forward as she fell. Her fingers hit and then caught the edge of the floor on the far side of the trap.
Anya!
Here!
Whatever you do, don't let go and don't look down.
Anya turned her head slightly and saw a gaping hole where the floor used to be. Mason was nearby, balanced on a small ledge against the left-hand side of the corridor. He stood on his toes, the ledge beneath his feet no more than an inch or so in width, with his body flattened against the wall for balance and his arms outstretched on either side. Of course, telling her not to look down resulted in her doing just that, her curiosity getting the better of her. A gaping chasm dropped away into the darkness beneath her feet. The bottom was too far away to be seen, if there was one at all.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
She'd been so caught up in what they were discovering that she'd let down her guard. She should have realized that the tomb would be rigged. She was only surprised that they'd made it as far as they had without any problems. She shifted her position slightly, getting her feet in contact with the wall in front of her, and using her toes as leverage wherever she could find purchase against the rock. She pushed and hauled herself free, one inch at a time. Once she had pulled herself out, she stood and waved to the others across the gap.
I'm fine.
She turned her attention to Mason. He was standing on that tiny ledge, less than 3 feet from the other side. If he jumped, he was almost certain to make it. With Anya there to catch him, he should have no trouble at all. As she watched, the muscles in his left leg began to shake. He couldn't hold his position for much longer.
You've got to get off that ledge while you still have the strength. Just push off the wall in this direction. It's not far. Less than 3 feet or so. I should be able to grab you easily.
No.
All you have to do is fall sideways.
I said no.
Perhaps it was her use of the word fall. She wasn't sure. But Mason's sudden attempt to push his body through the wall he was leaning against let her know she wasn't helping the situation much.
What are you going to do? Stay there all afternoon?
Yep.
But the ledge where he was standing had different ideas.
Mason!
Mason wasn't listening. He was too busy working to find purchase for his foot to avoid falling into the gaping chasm itself. After a second of scrambling that felt like a lifetime, he managed to get his foot back on solid ground.
That whole ledge is going to go soon. You've got to jump.
Anya thought he was going to argue with her again, but the sudden shift of stone beneath his feet for a second time prompted him into action. Pushing off the wall with both hands, he threw himself toward Anya. She caught him with open arms, and the two of them slammed to the ground.
Thank you.
Mason's face was only inches from hers. His body covered most of her own, and she could feel herself wanting to maintain their closeness.
Don't mention it.
They climbed to their feet to see Williams and Vale on the other side of the now obvious tiger trap, next to a quite visibly annoyed Davenport. The millionaire gestured at the 20-foot-wide gap that separated the two groups.
How the hell are we supposed to get over there now?
Several ideas were floated out, but most of them seemed impractical or excessively time-consuming. Knowing that Ransom was actively hunting for them made every wasted moment seem precious, and they didn't want to do anything that might significantly slow their progress. In the end, it was decided that Vale, Williams, Davenport, and Nambai would work to construct a bridge across the gap, while Mason and Anya continued on without them. No one was thrilled with the idea, least of all Davenport, who was crushed with the thought that the pit might keep him from being in the advance party that would be the first to lay eyes on Genghis Khan's resting place. Still, like any good leader, he recognized what needed to be done and ordered the others to make it happen. New torches, to replace the ones they had lost when the trap was triggered, were tossed across the gap, and Anya and Mason continued on. They passed through the door at the other end of the corridor and into another room similar to the first, except in this chamber the paintings depicted scenes of conquest from Genghis Khan's long military career. One particularly brutal painting showed the city of Nishapur just after its people had revolted against Mongol rule and killed the husband of the Khan's daughter. The daughter asked that everyone within the city limits be killed, and the Khan acquiesced to her wishes.
Nice guy.
They noticed there was a door at the far end of this gallery, just like the one before, and beyond, another short tunnel with a third door at the far end. Having been fooled once, they didn't take any chances this time. Mason used the stock of his weapon to test the way ahead, banging it against the stone hard enough to be certain it was going to hold their weight before they stepped forward and tested the next area. In that fashion, they crossed the entire length of the passageway and finally stood in front of the door. The light from their torches fell on a bas-relief carving above the lintel, displaying the face of a Mongolian warrior. His eyes seemed to gaze down at them in judgment. So strong was the illusion that Anya half expected it to open its mouth and ask what they wanted. Beneath the figure was a set of Mongolian letters carved on an ivory disc about 2 feet in diameter, the white of the ivory contrasting sharply with the dark stone in which it was set.
What do you think that's for?
Anya shook her head. She eyed it suspiciously and then turned and looked at the empty corridor behind them. An uneasy feeling was building in her stomach. After the collapsing tunnel trap, this passage had been too easy. She'd missed something. She turned back to see Mason reaching for the door, intending to push it open.
No, wait!
Mason's hand pushed against the door, but it didn't open as expected. Instead, it sank several inches into its frame and then stopped.
What the hell?
The bottom edges of the left and right-hand walls fell backward, revealing a long, narrow opening.
Oh!
Water began to pour out of those openings, and in less than a minute, both Anya and Mason were standing ankle-deep in freezing cold water as more flooded into the room by the second.
The other door!
They rushed for the entrance. A stone slab slid down from the ceiling and blocked the door. Mason threw himself at the barrier. The water was still rising, up to mid-calf now. Jones looked back at her.
Now what?
Anya spun around, taking in everything in the corridor, looking for the solution, the way out. Her gaze fell on the carving of the Khan and the ivory wheel beneath it. Her rudimentary knowledge of the Uyghur script told her that the arrangement of letters on the wheel translated into gibberish.
Why put a series of letters there if they didn't actually spell anything? Come on!
She took off back down the length of the corridor without waiting to see if Mason was following. Reaching the door at the other end, she discovered that despite her height, she could not reach the ivory wheel. Mason had already figured out her quandary, however, and bent over so that she could climb up on his back. From there, he leaned against the door, using it for support, while she clambered all the way up until she was standing on his shoulders and found herself directly opposite the disc. This close, she could see that there was a small arrow just below the image of the Khan, pointing down at the disc.
I don't know what you're doing, but whatever it is, you'd better hurry.
In that short time since the flooding had started, the water had already risen over Mason's knees. Working quickly, Anya spun the disc like a combination lock, lining up each letter in the name Temujin with the arrow below the carving. She looked down, noting that the water was now up to the middle of Mason's chest.
Try the door.
With his hands already against it to help in holding Anya up, all Mason had to do was push.
Try it again!
Nothing!
What did I miss? Try the right password?
Anya tried the Khan's given name twice more, moving the disc only clockwise the first time, and then when that failed, trying the same thing in the other direction. It still didn't work.
Anya?
She looked down and saw that the water was almost up to Mason's chin. He looked up at her, a strange calmness in his gaze.
Better hurry.
She turned back to the disc. She needed a different password. That had to be it. But she had no idea what.
What would have been important to the ruler of the known world? You know, power, territory, his title?
There were too many options, too many choices, and not enough time. She realized that the water had just risen over Mason's face. She had less than a minute or two. With one last desperate attempt, she tried again. The door in front of them burst open, carrying them forward in the rush of the current. Anya went under in the sudden flood and was swept away from Mason. She felt herself slam into a few objects and got tangled up in them. Couldn't tell what they were, and she was carried several yards into the room by the receding waters. In moments, it was over. Wet, tired, and very thankful that she remembered the name of Temujin's first and favored wife, Borte, she came to rest on the stone floor. Something heavy lay atop her. Her left hand was pinned beneath the weight, but she could move her right, and she used it to pull her flashlight from the cargo pocket of her pants and turn it on. A mummified Mongol face stared down at her from just a few inches away, its blackened flesh shrunken against the bones of its skull, its eyes deep in their sockets and dried out like oversized grapes.
Anya!
The mummy was suddenly pulled away, and Anya found herself looking into Mason's concerned face.
Are you okay?
She nodded, still too surprised to speak. Mason helped her climb to her feet, and together they shone their lights across the space around them. Mummified Mongol warriors were scattered everywhere around the room, thanks to the force of the now-drained floodwaters. They were all dressed in Mongol battle armor, and many still held the swords and shields they had been posed with so many centuries before. Anya shone her light into the face of one of the mummies and bent over to take a closer look. The wide gash across his throat had been stitched shut, the haphazard way it had been done removing even the smallest doubt that the repair had been anything but post-mortem. By letting her light play over the other figures nearby, Anya could see the same wounds on each. She suspected they had gone to their deaths knowingly, ready to follow their Khan into whatever world came next, and that only made it all the more unnerving. Here, the honor guard that had probably stood in orderly rank and file had once lived and breathed. It brought a strange and eerie presence to the place, as if the dead had come to life and now walked about the place on silent feet. Shining their lights down the length of the passage showed another set of wooden doors at the very end, opened by the force of the water that had passed through them. Without a word, Anya and Mason stepped over the tangled ranks of the dead piled up near the doors and crossed the threshold. The final set of doors opened into a massive, natural cavern. If Anya hadn't been so mesmerized by its contents, she might have amused herself for hours looking at the way nature had carved its own little hideaway from the bare rock. As it was, she could barely take her eyes from the rows upon rows of warriors, organized in regular columns of 10, 3 to a side. Like the warriors in the entry hall, these were mummified as well. So were the steeds on which they rode. She had found the fabled 60, the warriors who had accompanied Genghis Khan's body on its long journey back to the homeland, and who had given their lives in order to keep the location of his tomb a secret. The silent ranks stared back at her, and for a moment she could almost feel the challenge in their dead eyes, could almost hear the snort of the horses and the clank of the armor as the warriors moved slightly in their saddles, could feel the anticipation they held as they prepared to ride forth for their Khan. Mason's hand on her arm brought her back to herself.
Hey, you okay? You looked a little woozy there for a moment.
I'm fine. Just still catching my breath, I guess.
And as she turned away from him to glance at the soldiers once more, she saw it. An enormous tent stood all on its own just beyond the squads of mountain warriors. It was easily 10 times the size of the gurs Anya had seen being used outside the city limits, and must have required 6 carts or more to transport its materials. Those who'd lived in such a place must have lived like kings. Or queens. She knew she was right the minute the thought occurred to her. After all, they had found the 60 members of the missing honor guard, those who supposedly stood watch over the 60 brides, if the message was still to be believed. That meant the massive gur had probably been erected to fulfill another element of the prophecy. It was to be the living quarters for the harem that had followed Genghis into eternity. Of course, there was only one way to find out. Anya crossed through the ranks of the dead, mounted the steps leading to the entrance of the Gur, and pulling back the heavy felt doors, she stepped inside. Raised sleeping pallets lined the interior of the Gur, each one covered by its own draped canopy of silks. A dark shape occupied the center of each platform. Anya stepped up to the nearest one and drew back the silk curtains, shining her light inside. The mummy of a young woman stared back at her from the center of the bed, its wrinkled face and hardened eyeballs framed by a long, luscious swath of black hair. The mouth was partially open, which, when combined with the protruding eyeballs, gave the corpse the appearance that she was about to speak. A quick count of the sleeping platforms told Anya her suspicions were correct. They had found the 60 virgins. This one was dressed in the remains of a traditional faded blue dell, blue being the Mongol color of eternity, and on her feet were a pair of brocade slippers that Anya suspected were part of the plunder Genghis Khan had taken from somewhere in China. She looked peaceful as an 800-year-old mummy could look. Mason and Anya went around the room, drawing back the silk curtains one by one, looking for anything that might possibly contain the final directions they needed to locate the Khan's gravesite. In each bed, they found the same thing, a lovingly dressed mummy of a young Mongolian woman. That was all. No clues, no map, no hidden verses. They were running out of options. The final section of the Gur was sectioned off by intricately designed tankas that looked as if they had been made by the same craftsman who had crafted the one in which the black sulda had been stored. They had the same recurring patterns, the same symbols scattered throughout, the same colored fabric. With nowhere else left to look, Anya pulled back one side of the thick fabric and looked into the inner sanctum just beyond as Mason peeked over her shoulder. A platform about the size and height of a pool table rose out of the floor, as if it had been hewn from the living rock. A figure lay atop the platform, and even from where they stood, they could see that it was dressed in armor that hadn't seen the light of day in hundreds of years. Thick dust coated it, but Anya could still make out the vibrant colors that had been painted on the leather plates, the sheen of the silver rings that made up the mail coat beneath, the snarling wolf's face that had been painted on the shield that was hung on the wall behind the body, along with a sword and bow. Both arms were crossed over something resting on the corpse's chest, but from where she was, she couldn't make out what it might be. Rising up behind the platform like a ceremonial flag was a sulda, identical to the spirit banner they had found at Shank, except for one respect. This one was white. It was the sulda the Khan had used in times of peace.
Is that?
Anya didn't know, but she had to find out. Slowly, almost reverently, she stepped closer to the funeral bier. A helmet rested atop the head, and she recognized it immediately as the kind worn by Mongol warriors after the unification of the empire. It had a headpiece made of iron and flaps of leather that came down over the ears and the back of the neck, to protect them from attack. A square piece of silk covered the front of the helmet, and as a result, the face it rested on as well. Her heart was beating so hard, her hands were shaking, as she gently picked up the edge of the silk covering and drew it to one side. A blank, featureless face stared back at her. She recoiled in surprise, then realized that she wasn't looking at a body at all, but just a primitive mannequin made from bundled cloth. Disappointed, she stepped back to let Mason have a look. As she did so, her gaze fell on the thick book the mannequin held in its hands. Under the dust, the leather cover was stained a deep blue, and a series of words had been branded into its surface. She could recognize the writing as Mongolian, but that was all. With a start, she realized she might be looking at the great Yasa of Genghis Khan. Because of the diversity of the tribal units that made up the core of his empire, Genghis chose to allow local leaders to govern the way they traditionally had, provided that they did not violate the universal laws that the Khan put into place. The laws did not cover day-to-day life on the steppes, but rather dealt with only those that could cause the most discord. The laws were written on white paper and bound in blue to match the color of the eternal sky above. In time, the book itself became known as the Great Yasa, the Great Law. Being careful not to damage anything, Anya lifted one of the mannequin's gauntlets and slid the book out from underneath it before returning the hand to its proper place. Turning away from the platform, she took a deep breath and blew as much of the dust off the cover of the book as she could. Satisfied that she wouldn't get any dirt on the pages, she sat down and very gingerly opened it, leafing through the pages. She noted the careful writing, the orderly handwritten script. There wasn't a single correction, not a single mistake. That supported her belief that it was the Great Yasa, the written text of Genghis Khan's universal laws. She'd know for certain once she had Nambai look at it, for the written language of the Mongols had changed little in all the intervening years. She let her gaze sweep the room, trying to figure out what she had missed, where she had gone wrong. She just didn't understand. As far as she knew, she'd interpreted each line of the coded message correctly, going from one clue to the next. She'd found the Sulda at Shank and used that to lead them to the hidden chamber inside the cliff face containing the map. The map had led them to what was clearly the Tomb of the Virgins.
If the coded message was correct, the tomb was then supposed to lead them to... Wait a minute. Where was it supposed to lead?
Anya pulled out the card she'd been carrying around in her pocket for days and reread the last few lines of the message.
The 60 brides rode 60 steeds and now rest beneath the watchful eyes of those who came before. In their arms is the truth you seek, the way to all that was and more. Then climb to the place where Tiengri and Gazan meet. It is there that the Butter makes his home.
The last two lines made sense. Tiengri was another name for eternal blue heaven, and Gazan was the name for Earth Mother. So, where Tiengri and Gazan meet was where the sky met the earth. That could only be Burkhan Khaldun, God Mountain, the highest point in the region. And Batur was simply a Mongol word for clan leader or chief. So the clan leader, in this case the Khan, made his home on God Mountain. The tomb was somewhere on Burkhan Khaldun. That's what the tomb, or rather the clue hidden in the tomb, was supposed to tell them. Except it didn't.
In their arms is the truth you seek, the way to all that was and more.
She wasn't certain who the lines were referring to. The 60 brides or the soldiers, listed as those who came before. But what was clear was that the next clue was supposed to be in their arms. They'd examined each of the bodies carefully and hadn't found anything. That's when it hit her. She hadn't noticed it before, but looking at it repeatedly, she saw that there was a distinct break between the last two stanzas. Unlike the earlier portions, which seemed to flow from one to another, there was something disjointed about how the fourth stanza flowed into the fifth. The way to all that was and more was followed by, then climb to the place where Tiengri and Gazan meet. They didn't go together. It was almost as if there was a line or two missing. A sinking feeling filled the pit of her stomach. She had made a mistake, had missed something. That was the only possible answer. Disappointed, Anya and Mason made the decision to return to the others. They retraced their steps, heading back through the Hall of Warriors, as Anya was now calling it, and into the connecting tunnel where they had nearly drowned, only to meet the others coming through in the opposite direction. The stone slab that had previously blocked their escape route was gone. Davenport told Anya and Mason about how he and the other three had been sitting on the far side, trying to think of some way through the barrier, when it just quietly slid back upward into its previous location. Fearful that it might close on them again, they had gone back and brought logs down the tunnel with them, using them to brace the stone in its upright position just to be safe. They had just finished doing so. Word of what Mason and Anya had found fanned the curiosity of the rest of the team, so Anya agreed to take them back inside the cavern to give them a chance to see for themselves. Mason chose to remain behind. He'd seen enough mummies for one day. While he waited, they tried to come up with a plan as to what to do next. They had accomplished so much. They had found the Khan's Sulda, long thought lost to antiquity and the ravages of war. They had used it to locate the Voice of the Earth and the map chamber with it. They had used the clues in the map chamber to bring them to the legendary Tomb of the Virgins. They were so close he could taste it.
But now what? Without that missing clue, we could flounder around for weeks without finding anything.
Short of heading back down the mountain, the only option he could see was to check out the region on the other side of the rope bridge. It had been built for a reason, and so it seemed the natural course of action to take.
What do we have to lose at this point, anyway?
When he laid out the plan for the others upon their return, they agreed that it made sense. The bridge, it would be. When they reached the cemetery clearing, they decided to take a 5-minute rest break. Mason turned to Anya with a smile. Anya watched an expression of confusion cross his face, and then they were both looking down at his chest, where an angry red flower was rapidly blossoming. Anya's combat reflexes took over. She threw herself sideways into Davenport, knocking him to the ground. Williams and Vale were practically torn apart by the fusillade.
Throw down your weapons and come out with your hands over your heads!
Had chance of that.
Anya raised her head off the ground to try to get a look at what they were up against. Anya crawled behind a nearby boulder. Davenport had already taken cover in the same location. If they crouched very close together, the stone was just big enough to cover both of them. If they stayed there, they were dead. Anya knew it was as simple as that. Some of Ransom's men would pin them down with gunfire while sending others around to flank them on the sides. Eventually, the enemy troops would simply walk up and shoot them both in the head. She jumped to her feet, dragging Davenport with her.
Run!
She shoved Davenport ahead of her and headed for the forest. The thick trees protected them until they were out of sight of the ambushers. Anya knew they'd be following soon, however. Ahead of her, Davenport stumbled and fell forward, but Anya hauled him back to his feet, practically dragging him after her. Her plan was to get to the bridge, cross it, and cut the ropes before Ransom's men could reach it. Hopefully, that would give her time to figure out how to get them out of this alive. Visions of Mason being cut down by the enemy's gunfire rose in her mind, but she chased them away angrily. Davenport was her responsibility now, and she'd do her best to see to it that he survived. Their headlong rush down the meager trail continued, brushing aside low-hanging branches, stumbling over rocks partially hidden in the thick undergrowth, their breath pluming out around them in the high mountain air. Before they knew it, the trees abruptly gave way, leaving them exposed on an open stretch of ground that ended at the lip of the ravine. The bridge was directly ahead of them. The few moments it took to cross that open stretch of ground felt like hours to Anya, but then her feet hit the wooden slats holding the bridge together, and she had more important things to worry about. The bridge seemed ancient. Two thick ropes served as railings on either side. The wood slats were worn smooth from years of use in some places, and missing entirely in others. Anya went first, gripping the rope rail on either side tightly. Behind her, Davenport struggled along as best he could. The bridge rocked to and fro with their movement, and from the gusts of wind that buffeted them. Anya kept her eyes on the far side, trusting her balance, not wanting to be constantly reminded of the sheer drop beneath her. She was about 3/4 of the way across the bridge when a horse burst out of the trees on the other side. Its rider stood high in the stirrups, leaving his hands free to knock an arrow on his bow and aim it directly at Anya's head. She froze, astonished by what she was seeing. The man on the horse looked as if he'd just stumbled out of the history books. He wore armor made from cured leather and overlapping metal plates, and a helmet complete with a plume of horsehair. A small, round shield was strapped to his lead arm. The rider's gaze met hers. He shook his head. His message was obvious. You are not welcome here. He tucked his head back down and sighted carefully along his bow. Then several other riders emerged from the trees behind him and quickly spread out into a semicircle at his back. Many of them had arrows pointing in her direction, though some suddenly shifted position and aimed at something on the other side of the ravine. Anya turned and looked behind her. Ransom and his men were emerging from the woods. They spotted the fugitives and the Mongol cavalry, and also fanned out along the lip of the cliff. At their leader's signal, the Mongols let their arrows fly. Suddenly, Anya and Davenport were caught in the midst of a savage firefight. Bullets and arrows flew back and forth around them. Anya turned to her left just in time to see Ransom's helicopter rise up out of the depths and hover in line with the bridge itself, looming there like some great dragon out of legend. The downdraft of the chopper's massive rotors sent the bridge swaying crazily. The chain gun mounted under the helicopter's nose turned in their direction. A sudden gust of wind tossed the helicopter to one side. Instead of hitting Anya and Davenport, the bullets ripped through the cluster of Mongol warriors. At the same time, the helicopter came dangerously close to smashing into the edge of the canyon. Anya watched it lift up and out of the narrow confines of the canyon, knowing beyond a doubt that it would be back. Anya glanced at the far side of the bridge. The helicopter attack had thrown the Mongol formation into chaos. If they were quick enough, they might just make it across. Her gaze met Davenport's, and she knew he was thinking the same thing. Anya threw herself into motion. Suddenly, she was trapped. Her leg pushed through the shattered plank all the way up to mid-thigh. The other one bent at the knee, while she clutched frantically to another plank several feet ahead.
Anya!
I'm okay.
But Davenport hadn't seen her fall. His attention was on the helicopter rushing toward them in an attack run from above. Davenport threw himself toward her. Anya closed her eyes. The bridge broke in two. Anya grabbed Davenport's hand. Their half of the bridge hurtled toward the cliff face on the far side of the ravine. When they stopped moving, Anya was hanging by one leg upside down in the remains of the bridge, with Davenport slung beneath her, the only thing connecting them, their mutual holds on each other's wrists. He looked up at her, the fear bright in his eyes.
Don't drop me!
Anya couldn't even find the energy to speak against the pain roaring through her arms. She knew they couldn't stay like this for long. In the helicopter, Ransom leaned forward with eager anticipation.
Did you get it?
Santiago peered anxiously through the windscreen and then shook his head.
They're hanging on the remains of the bridge, about 15 feet below the rim.
Make another run. This time, don't miss.
Before the pilot could carry out his employer's orders, however, the helicopter came under fire again from the Mongols on the cliff edge. Arrows, spears, and bullets smacked into the frame and the windscreen. The pilot reacted accordingly. He got the heck out of there.
Where are you going?
Sir, we're under attack! I'm getting out of
here! I don't give a rat's arse what you think, you idiot! Get us back down there now!
The pilot spun the helicopter around and made another run at the spot where Anya and Davenport were hanging on for dear life. Anya saw death coming for them down the length of the chasm. Just another few seconds and the chain gun would let loose again. At that range, it would be hard for them to miss. Anya looked down toward the water far below. It was an extreme long shot, with probably less than a 1 in 100 chance of survival. That was still better than their odds of staying where they were. Anya looked down at Davenport.
Brace yourself!
Anya reached into the otherwear with her free hand. Davenport's eyes widened at the sight of the sword. Then they got even bigger as she swung it toward the guide rope on her right. Davenport opened his mouth to say something, but whatever it was lost in the roar of the oncoming chopper and the howl of the wind in her ears. Twisting the other way, Anya lashed out with the sword a second time. Ransom watched in satisfaction as Davenport and Creed dropped into the chasm, their forms quickly disappearing from view in the mist and spray from the river far below. He would have preferred to blow them all to hell himself, but he'd settle for this if he had to. Besides, the idea that they were likely conscious for the entire fall only added to his glee at their demise. He looked up, intending to share his congratulations with Santiago, and froze. Through the window behind Santiago, he could see one of the Mongol warriors rushing out of the woods with something long and slender in his hands. As Ransom watched, the warrior knelt and pointed the tube directly at the helicopter. For just a moment, their eyes locked. Then the warrior pulled the trigger and sent a rocket-propelled grenade spiraling up toward them. The warhead severed the tail rotor and sent the chopper spinning out of control. Ransom and Santiago braced themselves as the pilot sought frantically to get control of his aircraft. The sky whipped past, once, twice, three times, and then Ransom had an excellent view of the forest coming up quickly outside the same window he'd looked through before. Ransom regained consciousness slowly. One eye was crusted shut with what he thought might be dried blood, but the other one worked just fine, and in the dim light he could see that he was hanging upside down from his harness in what was left of the helicopter. His chest hurt where the straps had yanked themselves tight on impact, and his left arm felt like the Jolly Green Giant had been playing tug-of-war with it. But other than some minor cuts and bruises, he was intact, as near as he could tell. He had blood in his hair and on his shirt, but he didn't know if it was his own or someone else's. There seemed to be only one way to find out. With a shaking hand, he reached across his chest and tripped the harness release mechanism. Ransom fell onto what had once been the interior ceiling of the aircraft with a flash of pain. He lay still for a moment, catching his breath, but then pulled himself to his knees. From that position, he was able to look around the cockpit. The windscreen was gone, torn away by the shards of one of the rotors. So, too, was the pilot's head, though his body was still strapped in place, his hands on the controls. Santiago seemed to have fared better. Ransom couldn't see all of him, but what he could see didn't appear to have any major bodily damage, nor was he leaking a pool of blood onto the floor. The wreck was filled with acrid-smelling smoke and the stink of aviation fuel, so Ransom decided it was best to get out of it as soon as possible. On hands and knees, he crawled over to the edge of the wreck, where he could see a wide band of sunlight shining in. The hole was just big enough to crawl through if he got down on his stomach and wriggled. He did just that. Feet first, he pushed himself through the opening and into the clean air outside. When his head at last passed through the gap and he sat up, he found himself surrounded by the Mongol warriors he'd seen back at the pass. He caught movement out of the corner of his eye.